Blog Talk Radio.
I was in a prison, and life builds prison around people. I had prison that I was born white in a racist society. I was born privileged in a classist society. I don't know that I could have ever broken out of what I call the race prison if I hadn't dealt with class. It's that assumption that is so embedded in you that you don't realize it's there, that your crowd is supposed to be running things.
They took you down there, and they asked you, was he a communist? Has he been a communist or a member of the Communist Party? And he refused to answer the questions on the ground of the First Amendment. The First Amendment is freedom of association, freedom of speech.
She and Carl were charged with sedition and overthrowing the whole state of Kentucky because they bought a house for black people.
The anti-communist sort of hysteria that was gripping the country and the anti-black hysteria all got rolled up in a ball and hurled at us. We were traitors to our race. We were communists. We were evil. We were the devil.
Antic, you can't kill an idea anyway, especially if somebody else catches hold to it.
Nonviolent direct action was people themselves taken to the streets. Black movement in the South shook the whole society. It was like the foundation stone was hit and the whole structure shook because it brought everything into question.
The men who pulled the triggers that killed 5 people here on the streets of Greensboro are dangerous men, but they are not the cause of our problem. The real danger today comes from the people in high places, from the halls of Congress to the boardrooms of our big corporations, who are telling the white people that if their taxes are eating up their paycheck, it's not because of our bloated military budget, but because of government programs that benefit black people. Our problem is the people in power who are creating a scapegoat mentality.
I don't think guilt is a productive emotion. I never knew anybody who really got active because of guilt. Everybody white that I know has gotten involved in this struggle got into it because they glimpsed a different world to live in. The meaning of life is in that struggle, that human beings have always been able to envision something better. I don't know where they get it, but that's what makes human beings divine, I think. All through history, there have been people who envision something better in the most dire situations. That's what you want to be a part of. You want to see the fruit of it, but that's what you want to be a part of.
Welcome to Fire Talk Production. We are here today to speak about the documentary Ann Braden, Southern Patriot, created by Ann Lewis and Mimi Pickering. Ann makes documentary films about social action, human rights, labor, environmental justice, and cultural documentaries. She came out of a movement to make media that creates opportunity for social change. Mimi's documentaries often feature women as principal storytellers, focused on injustice and equality, and explore the efforts of grassroots people to deal with community problems and work for change. You can see why these two women were a perfect combination to come together and create the documentary Ann Braden, Southern Patriot. Please welcome them to the show.
Hello, ladies. I'm so happy to have you on the show. I've watched this documentary already twice and probably will again, as well as researched pretty much every name in there extensively just to learn more. So I'm so excited to be able to talk about this. I want to start with you, Ann, and have you tell us a little more about yourself.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I'm really glad to be invited to be on this show. And to speak mainly about the Braden documentary. I'm you know, I'm kind of a product of the 60s and always been very interested in social change and making a better world. And that kind of positive focus, I think, is what's so different in some ways about this film, in that it looks at social change as a way to live and a way to be more powerful as a collective kind of voice in the society. And it's a way also to feel optimistic about things and that things can be better. So that's what I hope that this film and many others that I've made leave us in that kind of state of wanting to move forward and move our society forward.
Yeah, there's nothing greater than the social documentaries of historical events and just to be able to see what was really like then, especially for the next generation who didn't live it. And it may seem more foreign to them to think of a society like that, where to us, being raised in it, it was very common, and I completely identify with so much. I was born in Mississippi, raised in Alabama, and now live in Tennessee. So I think I have a pretty good concept of what the Southern mentality can be, as well as being born in the 60s. So, you know, this is definitely right in something that I'm very interested in. Mimi, can you tell us about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm a native of California, but I've lived now most of my life in the Appalachian area of Kentucky, the coal mining area, and worked with Apple Shop, which is the Apple from Appalachia, APPAL, and AIM is a part of that as well. And so we do media, radio, theater, all kinds of art primarily around issues related to the Appalachian region, but also other rural communities and other sort of underrepresented and underserved communities. So being in Kentucky, in East Kentucky, Ann and I both knew Ann Braden, although she lived and worked out of Louisville, Kentucky, which is about 4 hours from where I'm located. But she was, she had her fingers in a lot of activities all around the South and, you know, really the nation. And so we interacted with her in various different ways, and we're just really honored and privileged to be able, that she gave us permission to tell her story and work with her. And as you were just saying about the history, yes, it's been kind of amazing how many people, particularly younger people in Louisville, where Ann lived for all those years, don't know her. And then, you know, throughout Kentucky and the rest of the country, a lot of the history that's in the film is really not very well known, if known at all, to folks. So that's one of the really exciting things about making and distributing films like this is to get the word out and really let people know better about what our real history or parts of our history that are just not taught or told.
You know, I know a lot about the history in Mississippi, but I didn't realize the history in Kentucky being so similar.
Yeah, and so, Ann was not, you know, a lot of her work was really South-wide. And
yeah.
So she was very active in Alabama, Mississippi, all over. And Kentucky, there was a civil rights movement. Kentucky doesn't have as large an African-American population as some of the deeper South states, but there definitely were activities going on in Kentucky. In some respects, Ann and her husband Carl were not as openly involved in some of those because they had already been, branded as Reds and traitors and those
right.
kinds of things. They were very controversial in Kentucky and particularly Louisville till the 90s, really.
Yeah, that is, and we'll get into it deeper as the show progresses, but the communist word itself, labeled with that, it's even now, is has a very strong reaction. So you combine that with trying to do civil rights, and it can be a very dangerous combination, even within the people who claim to be supporting you.
Well, I think that Fred Shuttlesworth really defines it in the film a lot when he says that, you know, for a segregationist, being an integrationist during that time was to be a communist. I mean, it was a kind of a very broad category that people were put in who believed in African-American liberation movement. I wanted to go back for a second because I think that it's really important for folks to know that this title, Southern Patriot, is this newspaper that Anne and Carl edited, and called the Southern Patriot. And that was an integrationist newspaper that began in the 40s and continued on through the mid-70s. And it covered everything that was going on that was really important in the South. I really think that. And
oh, yeah,
that's
definitely.
Because I think I read it when I was in Kentucky at the first I came to Kentucky in 1973, and I think I read it in context with the Brookside strike in Harlan County. But also because I'm now in Texas, and I went into the stacks at the library here and found bound copies of all of the Southern Patriots, or nearly all of them. So this was a very, very important paper that gave meant that Anne traveled as a journalist and had contacts all through the South. There's wonderful stories from Mississippi, Alabama, you know, and Florida even, all through that period. So and we were fortunate to see those. And I think that probably a lot of people would have access to old copies of these through colleges and universities and through their even at public libraries in the South.
But you don't know of any source where they're available online at this point? Because that would be a very wonderful thing to have access to.
No, we think that would be a wonderful project for a university or an archive or somebody really needs to get those.
Yes, they do.
As you see in the film, there are quite a few visuals of the Southern Patriot and with photos and the stories. And I also add that, you know, there were a couple of people that grumbled about, you know, why did we call Anne a patriot? But as if patriot is a right-wing or negative name always. But in my thinking, you know, Anne was the greatest patriot. She most truly believed in the true democratic promise of this country. And, you know, she was also, of course, a worldly person. But I just think that, you know, sometimes we need to reclaim these words. And
absolutely.
And I think patriot is what she was.
Yeah, there's a part of the flag waving, this is my America type people who think that they own certain things, but they're also the people that are destroying what this society could be in a lot of ways by their behavior. So I completely agree that word fits her perfectly in my mind. Go ahead.
The other thing is this paper was created in the 40s, and in part there was this glaring contradiction between fascism, you know, fighting fascism in the rest of the world and putting up with it or even supporting it in southern states at home, which you know, I think is a really important idea that really in the South you had a fascist state, a fascist apartheid state that completely denied the rights of African Americans.
Right. Although we're not comfortable, most people aren't using that word, but we have marginalized them in every way we possibly could to a completely subservient role, and now we seem upset that people want to, you know, act like that was a problem. There's still a large portion of America that doesn't understand why that was a big deal.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's why I'm so glad, because I do a lot of shows, but I don't have whites on there as much talking about the social issues as I do people who have been oppressed. So I'm very happy to have someone from supposedly my side who wants to actually talk openly about what we're responsible for and what we actually did in a positive way. It's just so refreshing to have that voice on to say, this, I agree too, this is wrong. And I thank you both for all the time and effort you've put into making this, because it's definitely worth it historically to have it out there. So can each of you tell me about your relationship with her, starting with you, Anne?
Sure. So I think I actually, you know, I found it in this film that I worked on as an associate director, Harlan County, USA, there's actually a shot of a coal miner reading The Southern Patriot.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think I probably read The Southern Patriot all through that time, because I know I was, you know, interested in that, although I never thought of it as anything separate than any of the other things that were coming out at that time about the movement, various social movements and labor movements. I came into contact with, and I think probably Mimi did around the same time, although she might have met her earlier, around the Jesse Jackson campaign in the 80s, when
okay.
she was very involved with Eastern Kentucky and brought Jesse Jackson to Eastern Kentucky. Then Mimi and I made a film called Chemical Valley, which was a film about environmental racism and dealt with this relationship between Bhopal, India, and that horrible disaster there, and their other plant was in a Black Community Institute, West Virginia, just outside of Charleston. So we made a film together about the relationship of toxicity and environmental degradation in African American working class and other communities. And so that Anne became very involved in something called the Southern Organizing Committee. And that was a Southwide coalition group with Black leadership that comprised of all kinds of even very, very small grassroots groups. And they decided to have a conference at Tulane in New Orleans, and they invited Mimi and me down to it to show a clip of Chemical Valley. And my partner, Jim, was one of the people that was involved in organizing Appalachians to come down to that conference. So at that point, we were in direct contact, and we went to the conference, and it was an amazing thing that was really taken over by young people. And I think from that point on, we were both quite interested in Anne and certainly involved in what was she up to kind of thing, which was all kinds of, I mean, she just stayed active right up to her death. So she was very active in this new environmental justice movement that was defining ecology and environment in terms of communities rather than this kind of abstract, more middle class and white definition of environment as something that was pretty isolated from communities, and particularly working class communities and communities of African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans. So she was very active in that, and we were very interested in that. And then so that was kind of how I think both of us really met her. And Mimi probably has something to add about her relationship as it developed. The way the film happened was kind of unfortunately, a little bit later, and there was a request for proposals to do something about free speech and the Constitution, and I asked Mimi if she was interested in doing something about Robert Byrd, and she said no, not particularly, but she was interested in Ann Braden, and that's how the first proposal got written, which goes nowhere. Because people didn't really think of Ann Braden at the National Endowment as a particularly appropriate subject for a historical piece.
Oh, she's fantastic. She has, her story has everything in my mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we thought.
Oh, definitely. You were completely right. Don't listen to them. Maybe you want to tell us your interaction with her?
Well, it, like Ann said, a lot of it was similar. I do remember when I first moved to the mountains that one of the stories that was always told was about the what happened in Pike County, Kentucky, where a number of Appalachian volunteers and people working for the Southern Conference Education Fund, which was Ann and Carl's organization, were arrested for sedition and because they were organizing with local people to fight strip mining. So that was a part of the history and the lore of all people organizing in the region. And so, you know, I came to know of Ann and Carl Braden through that story. And then we did connect with her on different things, and that she helped organize this great rally for Jesse Jackson in Hazard, Kentucky, which is near Whitesburg. And this is his first presidential race, I believe. And they let out the schools and packed the gymnasium and the crowd, which was 97% white, just loved Jackson. And it was just a fantastic rally and really – you know, connected the African-American struggle to that of working people and miners and in a wonderful way. So that was great to be involved with Ann that way. And then over the years, you know, I kept wondering, she's such an amazing person with an amazing struggle. You know, why isn't somebody doing a film with her? And I kept thinking that a filmmaker in Louisville, there had to be somebody, you know, who would do it, and they would be close and have easy access to Ann, and it just wasn't happening. And then Catherine Fossil Kate published this wonderful book called Subversive Southerner about Ann Braden, and particularly about the whole issue in the 50s and 60s of how the fight for desegregation was tied into communism and the Cold War sort of used as one of the tools to fight that. And so when Kate did this book, I just thought, wow, there's all this wonderful background research done, and which really helps a filmmaker, you know, to have a lot of that material available.
Yeah.
And that seemed another reason to ask Ann if she would do the film. And so then Ann Lewis and I, we thought it'd be great to be in. We approached Ann Braden, who I think because she knew us and, you know, knew our politics and all, she did say yes. And I think she had also entered that time in her life where she'd come to realize that, as she says in the beginning of the film, you know, there was value in telling her story. And
right. By
telling her story, other people could learn about that history and that event. And, you know, she was always a very modest person and always thought African Americans should lead the struggle. And so she, you know, she was a strategist that kind of took a back seat. She wanted to be in the planning meetings and the organizing, but she didn't want to be the public spokesperson. So, you know, it was difficult for her to see herself as the subject of a film. But
yeah, she didn't seem comfortable by it, but felt it was necessary, which is amazing to see someone give that much, every inch of their life, and yet be so humble.
Yes, I think that's very true. Maybe that's in part because she's a woman.
Yeah, maybe, but, I mean, it's And she just, how tall is she?
About 4 feet.
She seems so little.
She is. She's teeny. I'd say she was under 5 feet or right around there. She's very small, but very dynamic.
Just a powerhouse, though. I mean, there was no stopping her. It just was.
Right. And she, you know, one of her very good friends and close colleagues was Ella Baker, the African-American woman who has a similar, you know, sort of story in the movement in some ways of being not very well known, given her role in helping to get SNCC going and the whole civil rights movement. But Ella and Ann both truly believed in the importance of there being, you know, democracy starting at the very grassroots level and it's encouraging leadership and building leadership. And so both those women took a real, you know, back seat to being out front and encourage new leaders to grow. I think there's a lot of similarities between them.
And I strongly encourage everybody not only to purchase this, but to look at each person who's in here. And especially on Facebook and YouTube, you can really get to know a lot of their piece in the puzzle. Because I spent the past couple of days literally looking up each person that came into the documentary. And you can find a lot of information on Facebook and sometimes even actually be speaking to the person within a short amount of time. But on this, because of the time frame, a lot of these people are getting very old. So it is a time-sensitive thing to get to know their story. Did you run into a lot of that because of the age range when you were doing this story and gathering people for interviews?
Well, I think that Ella Baker would have been wonderful, but she was gone quite a while. We did get Fred Shuttlesworth before he passed.
He was amazing.
And then most of, you know, thank goodness, most of the other people are still with us.
Right.
So, you know, people like Angela Davis, obviously still publishing, still very, very active. C.T. Vivian, same. And Bob Zellner, still active, still working. Al McSurley, so, you know, Dottie Zellner. All of them still very politically active and involved. Lou Lupka, who's a very old man, still very involved. You know, so these are people that not only are, you know, historic, but also continue their involvement and their activities. And so they are very accessible for people out there to find out more.
So, there's a great
fairly new book out about women's role in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, both black and white women. And I can't remember the name of it, from Plow to something, I think. But it's oral history.
I think I just got that book not too long ago, My Hand on the Plow or something.
Yeah, and so one of the things we hope to do is some screenings with some of those women. We've made some contact, and you know, one of the things I think we didn't get as much of in the film, although we get a later generation, but maybe we didn't do it in depth enough in what an impact Anne had on those young, particularly white women who got involved with SNCC in the early 60s. Because Anne was about 10 years older than most of them and had a family and really was a mentor to people like Dottie Zellner and Casey Hayden, a lot of them. So I'm looking forward and hope that we can have some screening to the film with some of those women to talk about the film and Anne and their experiences.
Is the book The Hands on the Freedom Plow?
I believe, yes, that's
sure
it.
That's right.
I actually have that right in my hand right now. I just won it from a show the other day.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and it's African American and white women talking about their experiences. Bernice Johnson Reagan is in there. It's really good.
Oh yeah, it looks like an amazing book. I haven't read it yet, but that's what's so interesting too about this. It's it connected so many pieces where I'd seen different people and I found them very interesting, but I didn't know how they connected to everything else. And as you get deeper in, you start to see the whole connection in the movement itself come to life, which is another great thing about you doing this documentary. I just loved it. Can you tell? Now, how did the Apple Shop, you said, came to existence? Because it originally, can you explain how it came to be?
Well, it was part of a war on poverty program, which you had a war on poverty in the late 60s and really trying to, it was a Kennedy-Johnson program, really trying to address poverty in black and white communities around the country.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, wonderful things came out of that, programs like Head Start and also a lot of grassroots organizing. But Apple was an effort to, there were a number of what was called community film workshops set up in different communities to train young people of color in film and television skills, in part to provide sort of vocational training for people to join the industry, and also as a way for those communities to use the media to tell their stories for the first time. And I always have to tell young people in particular nowadays is you didn't go to, you know, the store, or your phone didn't make, you know, move.
Right, didn't make video on your phone.
Exactly. So the cost of making a film were, you know, of the equipment and the film itself and the processing were thousands and thousands of dollars, and very, very few people other than the news media, you know, had that opportunity. So Apple Shop really was the place where young people learned filmmaking and began to tell stories about their neighbors and kin and family, and really providing a different kind of, a different perspective than what the media was covering.
Yeah, the truth. And that's extremely important. The more people you can arm with the technology to tell their own story, the more powerful they become and the less relevant the media that's bought and paid for is. So it's definitely a powerful tool to take back the message. And I'm kind of familiar. I wasn't raised in the coal mining communities, but my stepdaughter lived in West Virginia. So we would have to go up and pick her up and everything. And I always looked at the coal miners because her grandfather died of, you know, black lung and all that. And I've always been connected to their story. So I definitely at some time like to hear more about your other work, because I think it's very relevant. Was it her, Carl, who connected the poor whites with the poor blacks? Was that his movement originally?
I think Anne and Carl were partners on that always. I think it's very hard to separate one from the other.
Yeah.
But I think that, of course, Carl died in the mid-70s, so Anne continued on without him for a very, very long time. But I think that was the focus of their organizing from the beginning, was that there was that was the basic rift that of class and race that I think we're still dealing with, and that that there had to be unity of working people for change to happen at the grassroots level. And so, you know, there was always that emphasis, and the emphasis on whites organizing, whites to be part of the black liberation movement, because it was in their own interest as well. I think that was Ralph in political thought. from really the 30s on. I mean, that's a basic labor position, progressive labor position of that, the importance of that unity. So I'm not sure that they originated. They were certainly part of that. And it's a very core belief, I think, for anybody doing work in the South, that there has to be that unity.
And when you listen to the fact that she's talking about corporations in that video I played at the beginning and war budgets and all those different things, that fight is still pretty much the same. It has a different look, but we're still fighting for that same kind of thing, where the poor are being, more and more people are becoming the poor, and the war budgets are becoming bigger, and the corporations are becoming more powerful. So she fought pretty much, I don't know who's left to hate them, because it's like she hit every category there was between corporations and separatists and all kind of people. It's amazing that she was able to live to an old age without somebody doing something to her.
Yeah, and I think in terms of Anne and Carl's relationship, Carl came from a very, you know, working class socialist family. His father supported Eugene Debs, and who was a, you know, ran for president and got many, many votes. And I think Carl was named after Karl Marx, although it's a C and not a K. And so Anne said that Carl really gave her, taught her about class and the fact that there is class in America, the
right.
different side. And then I think she brought to the relationship this real understanding of racism and segregation and the political repression of the South. And so she, you know, really made that a key to whatever they did was dealing with racism. So they were, you know, they brought different things to their lives together and really, you know, formed this amazing bond, I think.
What was amazing about her is how she considered being rich in this society as a prison. And most people would be like, oh, look how lucky she is to be where she came from. But in her eyes, she didn't see it that way at all. Is that right?
Well, I think she saw privileges also being a white woman. And they weren't terribly rich. I mean, they were not, you know, old landed Southern aristocracy.
Right, but nobody was trying to kill them on a daily basis just for who they were.
Right, exactly. So her privilege, I mean, she really saw all of these kinds of intersections of privilege in terms of class and race. And so she really went to the other side. She really, you know, that was a very hard thing for her to do. And I think that's what she calls on all of us to do, is to really examine our own privilege. Not in order to feel guilty about it, but in order to join a movement that corrects that inequity and inequality in our society.
Right.
So I think that's a kind of a call, and she does that herself, and she does it in a way that I think is really amazing. She did this in person, and she does it in the film, where she talks about her own transformation in a very honest way. And that's terribly hard for people. I mean, people like to think that they were kind of born as different from everybody else, and that those people that were, you know, our heroes are in some way gifted from birth, you know, to somehow see the inequalities in the society. And she talks about her own act of discovery and her own transformation in some kind of stuff that'll make you cringe a bit, but that open admission of her own privilege is really important to her, and I think it's a way that we can all learn. You know that you know you never get rid of that, but you can certainly not have to. You know, it forces you to act as a human being in certain ways, you know, and that's a kind of a wonderful thing about her and her understanding of privilege.
Well, the transition process, which is one I had to go through as well, and I think any white person who eventually gets to see the other America that she talks about, as I have, there is a transition process where you have to become deprogrammed to all the things that you've heard growing up. And she put that so clear in her letter to white Southern women.
Mm-hmm.
Do you happen to have that available, that I believe no white woman reared in the South? Do you know what I'm speaking about?
Yeah. Yes, and we also have published that, republished it, both on the DVD, so if people buy the DVD, they would have a copy of that entire thing. It's quoted from, part of it is quoted in the film, and then also on our website it's also available so that people can look at that. It's a very profound letter to people in the movement about the intersection between being female and being white. And that, you know, and it really looks at the use of the rape charge as something to impact black communities, in particular black men.
That is true, and I never thought about that concept until I was reading her say, we as women are what they're using as the excuse to kill people, that, you know, men are trying to rape us and, you know, damage their women and the purity of their women. And if we refuse to be part of that, then they don't have that weapon to be able to use against these people. So that took a lot of personal clarity to come to that kind of concept. That one just blew me away. I loved the fact that she did that and then had enough guts to try to get other white women at the time to join us. Was just the strength that she had was incredible. I know
right.
I personally couldn't have done that level that she did with three little children, you know, and her husband, Jill, and everything.
Right. She wrote that letter to white Southern women in 1971 or 72, and it was also the time when, you know, the women's liberation movement was really growing, and which came directly out of the civil rights movement. And there's another wonderful book called Personal Politics that ties all that together. Well, you know, that movement was maybe, you know, women were becoming empowered and not recognized the need to support men at times. And I think so Anne's was not a popular piece to write at that point. You know, wait a minute, you know, you've got to look at how, you know, this whole issue of race and racism and women and men and all that. So she, like you say, she was incredibly brave. I think, you know, she demonstrated that throughout her life.
She's just amazing on so many levels. Go ahead.
She did. There were part of the film also talks about the 1974, 1975, when Louisville was ordered to segregate the schools through busing, and that became a very violent time for a while. And Anne's car was blown up, bombed. So she definitely received, you know, threats on the phone. And I think they always kept their phone number listed, but, you know, there were definitely threats and a few actions. So, you know, it was scary times a lot.
I don't know how, when you have children, how you have that strength to keep going when you're going into the darkest belly of racism there is, and have that, how you keep going. But I guess you have no choice, but because what is there to stay at? You know, you either keep going or you accept that society that's murdering people all around you. not really a choice, I guess.
You want the world to be a better place for your children and their children and all the generations, but
right.
I think it is a hard thing on the specific children, and I think, you know, her children, I think it was both exciting and exhilarating and also very difficult. They're growing up was not easy.
Can you tell us, and this is just mainly my curiosity, is what happened to her children, especially her son, who was so articulate in the way that he did that in the documentary? And I was just curious what became of him.
I can't remember where he went to school, but Harvard. Rhodes Scholar, and he's a lawyer, and he's out in San Francisco, and he's not, his politics are not as far to the left as Anne's, but he and Anne remained, you know, pretty close to the end of her life. And there's daughter Anita, who died in the 62, which was broke their hearts. And then their youngest daughter Beth she teaches and has worked internationally a lot, and she has a couple of kids, multiracial kids that Anne, you know, spent time with. We're not real active in Anne's life in Louisville, and we didn't go out of our way to include them in the film. Some people have thought, you know, we should have done more interviews with them, or, you know, but it just seemed to be the part of her story, that she most wanted to tell.
Yeah, it's very hard to decide what gets put in and what gets left out. But I could understand how it's a hard choice because, a parent's relationship with their child when they've been through so much can be a very complex thing. And if you don't know the behind-the-scenes story to it, then it can open a lot of different things, too. So I'm sure y'all made the right decision based on the knowledge that you have. I was just curious because, I mean, it was such a full speed ahead kind of life for these children, so I was just wondering how they turned out. As far as the footage goes, now, which one of you, Mimi, you did more of the gathering of research in the archives, or was that, which one of you did the archives more?
Well, we did do everything, worked very closely on everything together. I spent, because my schedule and my proximity, I spent a fair amount of time in Louisville there's a large collection. When Anne passed, the University of Louisville has a lot of her material in their archives, so I spent time there looking for, photos and various visual materials. And then through some things just by chance, talking to a filmmaker friend of mine and of Apple Shop, and mentioning that we were working on the film, his name is Jack Willis, and he said he thought that he remembered a film from the 60s about that had Anne or Carl in it. And so he helped us track down this film called Wasn't That a Time, which was done in the early 60s and was one of the early cinema verite documentaries where the cameras were lighter and filmmakers to move around, and they didn't use narration. And so it's a film that looks at, I believe, three different cases and people who chose to claim their First Amendment rights when brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee and say the committee had no right to question them about who their associates were. And so Carl was one of those people. And so that's where the sequence of Carl and Ann and the kids and Carl going off to jail for
Now, that's a special feature within the DVD, correct?
It is, yeah. The whole film is here.
Yeah, and
it's also Pete Seeger, so it's really interesting to see Pete Seeger.
Oh, I know. I didn't know who he was, and so when I saw him, then I looked him up, of course. And what an amazing person. And he's still alive, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So there's just so many interesting people. So with that, I want to ask each of you, out of all the archive stuff you looked at, what's the one part that made it all worthwhile when you found it? What's your favorite piece of the documentary that you just were so excited when you found? And we'll start with you, Anne.
Okay, so obviously this film, just as a film, was so incredible. I mean, it's a beautiful film that was reviewed by Eleanor Roosevelt. But the one that really hit me was that same speech that you mentioned after the Greensboro killings. And the thing that was amazing about that, aside from how totally relevant it is right now, you know,
right.
This is a speech and made in the 80s, and it makes your, you know, skin crawl because it's right now, it's still totally accurate. But the thing that really got me about that one is if you go to YouTube, you'll see the murders. You know, you can see people getting killed in, you know, because the news filmed that. Even on Wikipedia and even on YouTube, you never see two very important things. One is what came just before the people were killed. And the second is this incredible reaction among people all over the South that Anne helped to organize to come to Greensboro a year later and protest those murders. That lack is just really hit me very hard, that it's not even mentioned in just the general stuff that we feel like we have access to nearly everything now, and we certainly have access to so much more than we ever had before. But this film was done by the political party that was the Communist Workers Party that were the people that were murdered were members of that. And it was done by them, and then we got it through the widow of one of the people that was killed and through the filmmaker, Sally Alvarez. And that was really amazing, and Mimi initially found that as well.
And I think it was great respect for Anne, and I mean, huge respect for Anne among those folks that they, you know, they really wanted to help and helped us find the film. Even it wasn't the world's greatest copy at this point, but it was about all that exists. And so, you know, there were so many people who contributed to the film. Vincent Harding in the Veterans of Hope Project, which is out at the University of Denver. Vincent is a long time civil rights activist and a historian that worked on Eyes on the Prize. And he and his wife ran a house in Atlanta that I think the Mennonite supported, and lots of people passed through there in the 60s. It was sort of a safe house. And he contributed. He had done an amazing interview with Anne, you know, inviting her out to the School of Theology there and interviewing her, and then put that out on a DVD. And there's a whole series of people that he has interviewed that the Veterans of Hope has available on the Internet and DVD. And so he very generously made that material available to us, and it really covered a lot of Anne's story that we hadn't gotten to her. You know, we were in production, we were interviewing her and working with her when she passed away, but we were far from done with the interviewing that we wanted to do. So, you know, that was just filmmakers are not always so generous with their material.
Right.
Like, so that happened over and over again, and I think it just speaks to the respect and love that people had for Anne Braden.
So, because of her passing away, how did that affect the film?
Well, I think it was not a good thing for the film. I mean, you know, you kind of recover and move on and figure out other ways to do things. We were confronted, though, I think, and this is where I would speak as, you know, Mimi and I edited together, but I also did a lot of the kind of grunt work of editing. And just trying to keep this as much in her voice, I think it meant that maybe we didn't cover some things that we really would have wanted to, but we couldn't because we didn't have her voice on those things, you know. But I think at that point that it was more important for us to have how she saw the world, you know, letting the audience really see things through her eyes and through her voice and not interfering with narration. The film is totally unnarrated, and I think that's unusual for, particularly for a film about someone who has died.
Right.
So in that way, I think it made things more difficult. I think we might have gotten but at the same time, people were so generous with their material. I think they probably would have been just as generous had she been alive, you know, because she would have asked them then.
Right.
It still, I think, brought many people together and brought a real desire to have the piece done and out there. And so perhaps in some ways it made people more accessible. And then it brought a number of people to Louisville for her memorial. And so we were able to, you know, this was not an easy film to raise money. And so then we were able to go to her funeral and her, and particularly her memorial service, and capture people while they were there, rather than having to travel very far to interview people. So that, you know, that was helpful, although you hate to have it happen in those circumstances.
Right. But it really brought people probably that you didn't even know existed into the light as well, I would think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There were, as Anne said, you know, areas of her life, and you know, we didn't get to really talk to her about editing The Southern Patriot in detail. You know, I think it would have been interesting. One of the big issues with Anne and Carl is they decided that after the trials in Louisville and all of that they were not going to answer the question of, you know, were they or were they not communists. That was, you were damned if you didn't. And if you, no matter how you answered, you know,
right,
it was labeling it as something. And so I think it would have been, you know, and I think her son Jim was maybe not happy that she never answered that question before her death. But I don't think she was ever going to answer it. But I would have liked to have her talk about
right,
that, about those labels and her reasons for taking that stand.
Well, the issue about the communist piece is, like you said on there, a lot of people purged their roles or their organizations of anyone like that, which in its own way becomes what they're fighting against. And I think that, to me, what I took away is that she didn't want to become the same type of people who's doing a witch hunt against people, just as they're doing it against her out of fear.
Right.
Well, she was totally accepting. Yeah, I mean, she totally accepted anybody, certainly from the progressive area of politics, and she would work with people who were, you know.
Right.
And I think she would clearly say that she was a socialist. I mean, she was definitely anti-capitalist.
Right.
The question where it became specific was the one that she would not answer, was she, are you or now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And that she refused to answer. But I think she was quite willing to define her politics very explicitly,
right.
Talk about anything, any kind of theoretical question. You know, I think she was very, very open to any kind of political discussion. It would instigate them if you didn't, you know, on a very unrhetorical level. You know, she wasn't going to spout anybody's ideology at you, you know.
Right.
So,
one thing I wanted to talk about is the concept of the other America. And there was a moment when she was a journalist early on where there was a waitress, as she talked about there not being any news. You know what story I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that story? I just want to make sure and get that piece in there where people understand the times.
Sure. I guess I'll begin it at least, and then Mimi can fill in what I leave out. But the story is she's working at the Birmingham paper covering the courthouse. And there are these absolutely appalling cases coming up where people are, you know, subjected to jail time for intent, looking at a white woman, a black man looking at a white woman, and it's called ravishing.
Intent to ravage.
You know, it's
intent to ravage.
Yeah, so she's seeing these kinds of things, and she goes downtown for breakfast, and she meets a white friend who's down there, and one of the things, because she's a newspaper reporter, is she needs to call into the paper to see if anything really important has gone on, because then she would have to skip breakfast and go running to the courthouse to cover it. So she calls the paper, and she comes back to her table, and she tells her friend, no, there's nothing important, just a colored murder.
Right.
And at that moment, there's a black waitress. This is a kind of cafeteria-style restaurant, and there's a black waitress pouring coffee. And it's like she describes it as just this total shock that she realizes what just came out of her mouth. And she says in telling the story, I felt like putting my arms around her, saying it's not me that said that. It's my newspaper that determines what news is important, you know, and so forth and so on. And then she realizes that she really did mean what she said, that black life is somehow not important. And that is... that is one of her really crucial realizations, and it's a very kind of horrifying realization. And I doubt very much that very many of us, I think most of us would, if we did say something like that, I'm sure all of us have said something somewhat similar, we would probably leave it at the newspaper, you know. So she takes it this one step further and twists it in and tries to understand it.
Yeah. And that's what's so fascinating. Go ahead.
And then at some point she decided, you know, she really wanted to, but the problem was the South, and she really wanted to flee the South and her, you know, her upbringing and the segregation of the South. And so that's when she applied for newspaper jobs, and she got a job at the Louisville Times. But her goal was actually, she was hoping that would just be a stepping stone to go to New York and, you know, maybe write for the papers there and just really leave at all. But then when she got to Louisville, she met Carl Braden, and she, you know, she got engaged with a lot of the Progressive Party activity that was going on, the union organizing, the strong union movement there. This was 1947. She really connected and found that she, you know, she dealt with the issue of class. She kind of got involved in things, and that was another turning point in her life, doing that. And then, as a, you know, the story, another aha moment for her was a transformation was when she went to Mississippi and with a group of white women to petition the governor to save the life of Willie McGee, a black man who was convicted of raping a white woman with, you know, no evidence to that. And, you know, and she ends up being arrested supposedly for their own protection, but she just really realized at that point that she was on the other side. And when she came back to Louisville, she spoke to, she was going to black churches and, you know, telling about what she had experienced. And then she had a correspondence with William Patterson, who was head of the group that was sort of leading the Save Willie McGee campaign. And he said, "This is great what you're doing, but, you know, you don't really need to tell black people of these problems. They know them so well. You need to talk to white people." And that was another really big transformation for her that I think, as she says in the film, you know, sometimes you hear just the right thing at the right moment, and that for her really crystallized what she could do with her life, I think. And so, you know, and she really did from all the rest of her life find, you know, her essential thing was speaking to white people about their responsibility to undo racism and white privilege.
And the one thing I want to read, she said, "You don't have to be part of the world of the lynchers. You can join the other America, the people who have struggled against the oppressors." And that's very true, and still what we need to do today.
And so, what, you know, I think is so wonderful about Anne is that her, you know, she talks about, you know, white people need to do this not out of a sense of guilt, and that guilt doesn't you know, get you anywhere, but out of your own humanity and your own growth and being a person, and that, you know, the people, that's what she's talking about in joining the other America, or, you know, as the civil rights movement called it, the beloved community, you know, people who are really working together to make the world a better place.
What I'd like to do with both of you before we run out of time is I want to go to them purchasing the house. So can we begin first with the Committee of Un-American Activities and then backtrack in what happened about them buying the house and wrap that all up together, if that makes sense to you both? And if you want, maybe if you could kind of start and set the whole field of purchasing the house and to the committee.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll start with the house. And the Braden were involved in Louisville in various efforts to desegregate the community, and they, one of the campaigns they worked on was trying to get the hospitals desegregated, because they were not, they were segregated, and were cases of African-American folks, you know, dying because the hospital wouldn't let them in. So, so they were interested in desegregating housing, but a friend of theirs, Andrew Wade, and his wife Charlotte, actually asked them to buy a house for them, because he was a World War II veteran. He had a electrical company, you know, he was, and he wanted to move a little bit out in the country. And anytime he went to look at a house, the realtors would say, "Well, you know, no, they're not going to sell to you." And so someone advised him to get a white couple to buy the house and then resell it to him. So the Bradens did that not as a, what I understand, not as a real political act. I mean, it fell within the things they were fighting for, but as a more an act of friendship for the Wades. And so they bought a house in the suburbs of Louisville and then immediately sold it to the Wades. And then when the surrounding people realized it was an African-American couple moving in, there was a cross burn and rock thrown. And but the Wades insisted on staying in the house. So the Bradens and some others had kind of a committee to protect the house, and they were pressing the Commonwealth attorney to find out who had done these activities, and then someone set off a bomb under the house, which fortunately the Wades were not at home because it was right under their daughter's bedroom.
Well, again, 3 years old, right?
Right, exactly. So again, the Bradens were pressing them, you know, the group was pressing that the Commonwealth's attorney do something. And so the grand jury met, and when the grand jury met, they seemed to be focusing on the Wade Defense Committee and not any individuals who had bombed the house, and then released indictments of I think it's five people for conspiring to to stir up the races through house purchase, and they later indicted them for actually bombing the house. And the whole thing became about, they indicted them for sedition, and was all about that they were communists or, you know, Reds, and that they were trying to overthrow the government of Jefferson County, Kentucky. And so Carl was the first one to go to trial, and then it became, as Ann says, a real trial. They really didn't have, I mean, what did they have to base their case on? Nothing. But they went and took all the Braden books, and they took anything, you know, that looked had a Russian in it.
Looked foreign to them, yeah.
Right. So it kind of became a trial around what books you read. But anyway, then there were FBI informants. It was all very complicated. But they found Carl guilty of sedition.
He never stood a chance when you go in front of an American Activities Committee. They're not going to be your most liberal folks.
Right, and this was actually this was a grand jury and then a jury in Jefferson County, Kentucky, in Louisville. So, you know, it was a regular court case at this point. But there were definitely outside interests that were assisting the prosecutor with witnesses, and, you know, they brought in professional communist hunters to testify and those kinds of things. So, and then Carl was fired from his job, and then Ann and Carl were completely blacklisted in Louisville. There was no way that Carl could get a job, and I think Ann got a few jobs, like secretarial jobs, and I think in a couple of cases she worked for a little while, and then they figured out who she was, and they fired her. So it was very, very hard times for them.
I think I had just a few things to add, and one of them is this was 1954, so it was right when school desegregation came in, and so there was this political context too, particularly in the South, of real integration of communities, and so this became a really it was a time when there was a real desire for repression. And Kate describes it as Black Monday when the decision came down, because white Southerners were so appalled that the Supreme Court would say that schools needed to be integrated. So this is all happening in this kind of national context of both the anti-communist and the force of the civil rights movement picking up and beginning to try to transform the society. And the other thing that's very interesting about this is only even from the beginning, like when the house was attacked, if you read the newspaper headlines, it's whites buy house for black people. It's really clearly this kind of race traitor thing going in the, even in as progressive a paper as the Louisville Courier Journal. And then the whole railroading of people that was part of the McCarthy era, terribly dangerous. I mean, you know, you
it is as dangerous as
you know,
get.
It was really dangerous for them. And Anne talks about it in terms of knowing that the people in the community wanted to kill her and Carl, and really were openly talking about that kind of thing. And so there they are, and then having these children, no source of employment. Carl put away for 15 years, followed by this act of discovering people who would support them in using this attack as a way to raise the issue of housing segregation all over the country. I mean, taking this really vile personal attack into something that that can be used politically.
And it was, go ahead.
And then it was, so Anne traveled around the country trying to raise money for Carl's bail and, you know, met people who became supporters all around the country. And then they also connected with Jim Dombrowski, who was the head of the Southern Conference Education Fund, which published the Southern Patriot. And Carl did get, his case got thrown out on technicality, and then Dombrowski offered them jobs as reporters and sort of field organizers for SCEF, and they shared one salary and then took turns traveling through the South to report on what was going on. And SCEF really focused always on the role and necessity of white people to engage with the civil rights movement, be part of it. And then it was so, but SCEF was also branded as a communist-backed organization, and some of the other civil rights groups wouldn't have anything to do with SCEF. Again, the blacklisting stuff, and then so it was in that context that the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, asked Carl to, I think, to Atlanta, Carl and Anne both, to testify about whether you know, there were communists, they knew communists in the civil rights movement. And Carl refused to testify, claiming his First Amendment rights, which is the right to free association. And the McCarthy, those hearings are famous. Many people took their Fifth Amendment rights, which was the right not to incriminate themselves. But that was different from Carl and Frank Wilkinson and Pete Seeger and these others. And you know, was a good stand, I think. But he was found to be in contempt of the committee because he wouldn't testify, and was sentenced to a year in jail. Then, and Anne was supposed to also testify, but she kind of kept them at bay long enough to where they gave up trying to hunt her down, I think.
Wow!
So
they really,
you know,
went through hell and back.
They did, and they were really courageous. And, you know, all the time, Anne's parents were in Alabama and, you know, just horrified at Anne's racial stand, and but loved their grandchildren and did try to connect with them. And as Anne says, she never gave up loving her parents, and, you know, she connected with them when she could.
Right.
But it was very difficult.
It is, especially that older generation, getting them to understand these concepts is very hard.
There's one other thing. Anne would never tell this story without talking about the Wades. and the impact on the Waits. And the Waits were the black couple who, they were not indicted, which was in a way shameful. I mean, it was like they were saying that these white people had duped them, you know, these white communists had duped them, was the line of the case. And so Andrew Wade was really thwarted every single way as a, you know, and Charlotte Wade as well, as people with integrity and agency and everything. And they, you know, and so Anne would always talk about what, you know, in a way it made her and Carl, as horrific as everything was, it turned them into people that were well-known and active and all of that, while this black couple was thwarted. And she always talked about that when she talked about this case. She wrote a wonderful book called The Wall Between, which has been reprinted and is available, and that's by Anne, and it's really wonderful, about all of her feelings throughout this whole thing, and really talks quite a bit about her relationship with Charlotte Wade and her feelings about what happened to them.
Where are the Wades now and their daughter?
I believe they both have passed away. One of the things we were talking earlier about archival footage, we also were it was very exciting to find a television segment that from the 80s that was produced about Anne and the Wades, and Andrew Wade was interviewed in that, and so we used some of that in the film. It never aired, and so it was a little tricky to get footage again from it, but we were really glad to be able to include some of Andrew speaking about the whole issue. And I mean, his business really suffered, and you know, they eventually didn't stay in the house. They moved back into the West End of Louisville. You know, I think there were issues with the bank calling the loan, and it was a horrible situation for them too. They remained, you know, Anne stayed in contact with both of them, but I think she felt really bad that they, you know, they had borne so much trouble from this and you know, the whole situation. So, and I don't know where the daughter is, but, you know, Anne did stay in touch till the very end of her life with Charlotte Wade.
Well, we have not a lot of time left, so is there anything that either one of you would like to add before we close, starting with you, Anne?
Just that I hope that people see this film. It's available through Apple Shop, which is APPALSHOP, and it's also available through California Newsreel. And people can order copies or get in contact with us and let us know. I hope after they see it, they get in contact with us directly. And we do have a website, which is www.annebraden.org. And just hope to continue the conversation out there. I think this is a tremendously important discussion. And thank you so much, Nell.
Oh, thank you both so much. Mimi, go ahead.
Again, I just really, you know, we're only halfway, if that far, in the work of filmmaking. And at least the second half is getting the film, you know, out to people all over the country and beyond. And so we're undertaking that, and it's really exciting to participate in screenings. I find it really exciting to show the film to younger people, to people, you know, to college and high school people who don't know her story at all. I mean, I think it's a great story that makes activists very feel great and positive about their work, but I also think it's wonderful if we can turn new people on to these issues and the importance of them. And we're working with some organizing groups and interested in working with more, where we can use clips of the film for, you know, more workshops and those kinds of settings, and there's been some good work happening with that already.
Right.
So just, you know, look forward to continuing to do that.
Now, if somebody was wanting a screening or to do other work with this documentary, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, I think they can. We've got a Facebook page, which is Ann Braden Film, and the website, which is annbradenfilm.org or annbraden.org, or they can contact Apple Shop, which the number there is 606-633-0108, and we'll try to see what we can do.
All right. Thank you, ladies, both for coming on, and I definitely support your work, and keep me in touch with anything you're doing in the future, and I'll have you back on.
Great. Thank you for having us.
You have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Okay.
Now we're going to close with Pete's song, Wasn't That a Time? I think it seems fitting. Have a good evening, everyone.
Thank you.
Our fathers fled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood, their faith was warm. At Valley Forge, their faith was brotherhood.
That it's a very painful process, but it is not destructive. It's the road to liberation. And what really happened in the 60s was that this country took just the first step toward admitting that it had been wrong on race. And creativity burst out in all directions.
From the color of the faces in Sunday songs to the hatred they raised all the youngsters on. Once upon a time in this country long ago, she knew there was something wrong because the song said yellow, red, black, and white. Everyone precious in the path of Christ. But what about the daughter of the woman cleaning their house? Wasn't she a child they were singing about? And if Jesus loves us black and white skin, why didn't her white mother invite them in? When did it become a room for no blacks to step in? How did you already know not to ask the question? Left lasting impressions, adolescence, comfort's gone. She never thought things would ever change, but she always knew there was something wrong. Herself, Mississippi, bound to help stop the legalized lynching of Mr. Willie McGee. But they couldn't stop it, so they thought that they talked to the governor about what happened and say we're tired of being used as an excuse to kill black men. But the cops wouldn't let them pass, and these women, they struck them as uppity. So they hauled them all off to jail, and they called it protective custody. Then from her cell she heard her jailers grumbling about outsiders. When she called them out and said she was from the South, they shouted, why is a nice southern lady making trouble for the governor? She said, I guess I'm not your type of lady, and I guess I'm not your type of southerner. But before you call me traitor, well, it's plain it's just to say, I was a child in Mississippi, but I'm ashamed of it today. Within all of your neighbors and family friends, how would you cope facing the fact the flesh on their hands was tainted with sin? She faced this every day. People she saw on a regular basis, people she loved in several cases, people she knew were incredibly racist. It was painful, but she never stopped loving them, never stopped calling their names, and she never stopped being a southern woman, and she never stopped fighting for change. And she saw that her struggle was in the tradition of ancestors never aware of her. It continues today, the soul of a southerner born of the other America.
America.